And it's automatically recording this time.
I had that written down. Tell Charlie to hit the button.
Welcome to the Talking Poem Podcast. I'm your host, Charlie Green. Every other week, I invite a guest to bring in any poem they'd like to talk about for any reason. We'll talk about what excites us, what delights us, maybe what frustrates us, and we'll follow the poem and the conversation wherever they turn. Afterward, we'll have a little bit of silliness and a game. And today I'm so glad to have as my guest David Baker. This is technically the second time I've had him as a guest, but the first time that I will have recorded it. So David is a poet, educator, editor, and literary critic. He is the author or editor of 19 books, including 13 books of poetry, most recently Whale Fall, which came out from Norton in 2022. And he describes that as a 7-part lyric sequence, an eco-poem made of poems that examines the dying and extinction of animals, especially of sea life. If you know the name of a literary journal, he's had a poem or poems in it probably. Among his awards are prizes and fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, National Endowment for the Arts, and the Mellon Foundation. He was the editor of the Kenyon Review for over 25 years and is now a teaching emeritus professor at Denison University. David, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here again.
Thanks, Charlie. I'm really glad to be here. Poetry editor of the Kenyon Review, not the editor.
Oh, my apologies.
No, that's good. I would much rather be the poetry editor than the editor. That was a better job. I didn't have to do business, you know, just read a million poems. Anyway, I'm really happy to be here with you.
You've brought in the Gerard Manley Hopkins sonnet. It's one of the quote-unquote terrible sonnets, not because they're bad. That's not why they're called terrible. They're called terrible because they all have this sort of dark melancholy to them. But you've brought in No Worst, There Is None. And I know you taught this a while back, but I'm curious why you chose this poem instead of another Hopkins
poem.
Yeah,
this may be my favorite of the Hopkins poems. Though his favorite, I think, I read somewhere, his favorite was Wendover. It's a much more beautiful poem. This was terrible. Hopkins called it terrible in a letter to Bridges. He said, I have these new poems, they're terrible. And he meant, you know, as in full of terror, awesome. I chose this one. I love this poem and I love Hopkins. Not all of Hopkins, but I don't love all of anybody. But I chose this one out of a pretty practical purpose. I'm teaching this semester an introductory survey literature class in modern poetry. It's essentially, well, it's 20th century, modern and postmodern. And I've got 25 undergraduates from every kind of major you could imagine. I love that. I've got first-year students. I've got graduating seniors, you know, the whole shooting match. And it's just a blast of a class to teach. I chose this poem because this is the first poem that I gave them on the very first day. It wasn't assigned. I was going over my policy stuff and syllabus, and I said, okay, let's just figure out how we read and talk about a poem. And I'm going to give you a poem that's really a difficult poem, a challenging poem. And I read it and I said, okay, what do you think? How should we go about this? What do you hear? And they just kind of looked at me stumped for a while. A couple had seen it, most had not. And we talked about it then as an example of ways that we can open a door or a window to a difficult poem. How do you figure out how to read a difficult poem and how to talk about a difficult poem, a challenging poem? And then we summarized, they had some things to say. And I knew that I would have this chance with you. And so I asked them some questions at the end. I'm going to talk with this guy, Charlie Green, on his podcast. And what should we tell people about this poem? They had some advice. They had some reaction as well. But it was about how they come to a hard poem. And in this case, a poem that anticipates a lot of early modern stuff anyway. You know, Hopkins, I guess, is a Victorian poet, but there's something so prescient in his sense of modernity that it seemed like a good warm-up anyway. This is one of the kinds of difficulty we're going to have in this class, I said to. Anyway, that's a really long answer. That's why this one.
I mean, it's a good answer. I'm a little surprised that you give it to them just because of the tone is so so dark and dour, but it's still, it would be fantastic. It's a fantastic poem for that activity. And why don't I just go ahead and turn it over to you to read the poem, and then we'll
get into it. Dark and dour, you're right. But you remember, these are 20-year-olds. They dig dark and dour. okay, here's this poem. No worst. There is none. Pitched past pitch of grief, more pangs will. Schooled at four pangs, wilder ring. Comforter, where is your comforting? Mary, mother of us, where is your relief? My cries heave, herds long, huddle in a mane, a chief woe, world sorrow. On an age-old anvil, wince and sing, then lull, then leave off. Fury had shrieked, no lingering, let me be fell. Force, I must be brief. Oh, the mind has mountains. Cliffs of fall, frightful, sheer, no man fathomed. Hold them cheap, may who ne'er hung there. Nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep. Here, creep, wretch, under a comfort serves in a whirlwind. All life, death does end, and each day dies with sleep.
Oh, thank you so much. I love Hopkins, and I love this poem. I've had a lot of time to think about it since our first conversation, but I'm curious to hear how your students reacted to it, how they were able to make sense of it. And, you know, what they wanted us to talk about.
So I finished reading it, and I looked at them, and I had 25 cows looking at me with big cow eyes, like, what the hell is that, Dr. Baker? What are you talking about? And I just let it percolate a minute, and then I read it again, and they were stunned. And so we talked about strategies for how to enter a poem. I've used Stevens's Emperor of Ice Cream in similar ways. I've used a Dickinson poem in similar ways. But this one, I didn't want to get to Stevens yet because he was going to come later in the semester anyway. And I wanted some historical precedent with Hopkins. So we decided, here's what they said. They said, I have no idea what's going on. They said, it's really difficult. They said, I can't tell what the story is. I mean, these are all the right things they're asking. And one of them said, the sentences are all messed up. I can't tell what he's even saying. And those are the two primary ways into a hard poem. You parse the grammar. Where's the subject? Where's the predicate? What clauses are happening? What is actually word by word being said? And you get a sense of that sort of narrative, that sort of literal trop of the narrative. And then you begin to make those details assemble into something like images, into something like action, and tease out a story. And so we talked through the poem that way. And in fact, the poem is completely willing to reveal itself after a while, after you work through those questions. But those are the thorny issues with Hopkins, you know, syntax and how convoluted the syntax seems to be. It you know, is as much his Latin and Greek deliciousness as anything else. He's not trying to be obtuse. He's trying to be clear in some way, clear about something extremely wrenching. This is how he does it. So I went back after we talked about this poem with the class and said, what would you tell people? They would say, okay, the way to read this poem, we've determined, is you have to go line by line. You have to be patient. And it's not a poem that you're going to understand the first time or the second time or the third time. It's about rereading. And I'm like, oh, hallelujah, yes. And it's about perseverance. And somebody said it really helped to hear it out loud. I said, you know, I could sit and look at this thing on the page for an hour and have no idea. But when I hear the inflection of a voice and the emphasis grammatically of a voice, that really helped. one of them said, and I've got this all written down here, one of them said, it really helps to place the speaker in all of this landscape. You know, what's wrong here? There's something terribly wrong. It's a poem about trauma. Where is this speaker? And then somebody said, you know, find the central points. And that seemed like pretty good advice. Read it over and over, listen to the voice, listen to the syntax. That's what we talked about. And it turned out to be a really good way to begin that class because we hit a bunch of difficult poems along the way. And I'll jump to I'm doing all this talking here, Charlie. Sorry about that. But I'm going to jump to something that happened week. Honest to God, it happened this week. We're reading the confessional poets over this couple of weeks, Lowell and Sexton and Plath and Rethke and Berryman. And I finished with Berryman, whom I love. And we were talking about, you know, this is a very, very difficult poet, and it's a very traumatic poet. It's about, you know, horribleness in the mind and guilt and shame and the need to confess something that you don't even understand, you know, the cause of. And I said, as we summarized, you know, what did you think of this guy? And as I'm trying to do later in the semester now, who would you place him alongside? What kinds of affiliations do you hear? And, you know, they said, well, there's something of Plath here. There's something of Lowell here. Somebody said there's something of Auden here in this historical sense. And I'm waiting to be convinced. But a kid in class, he doesn't ever talk much. He said, you know, of all the poets that we've read, and he said, we didn't really study this one. He said, is that guy we read on the first day, who was that? I said, Hopkins? Because I've never thought about that connection. He said, yeah, this really reminds me of, and we were looking at some of the Henry sonnets. This reminds me of Hopkins. And a light went off with that complicated syntax and a kind of torturousness and an idiom. Hopkins' idiom tends to be fairly consistent. He's not going to change the instrument in the band. He's just going to play one really complicated instrument. And Berryman will make different kinds of sounds and speak out of different voices. But something about the rigor of those voices this kid was hearing. Isn't that a cool observation? I've never read anybody writing about Hopkins and Berryman before.
That's incredible. As soon as you said Berryman's name, it like, kind of had the same light bulb for me. Yeah, the tone and the syntax completely. And they're not poets who, I mean, as you said, I don't know that I've ever seen anybody link them together, in part because, you know, there's something so formal. We think of Hopkins in the religious tradition of his poetry, and there, you know, I think there's a tendency to think of him in terms of form. And it's not that the Dream Songs or other Berryman poems are interested in form, but they're just so different in so many ways.
They're similar in this way that's really spooky to me, and that's this kind of dramatic, radical interiority. Even though, you know, Berryman is performing, you know, as if he's on stage, he's so deep in that tortured mind. And there's something formally parallel there. Berryman's poems aren't sonnets, but they remember that form. And they remember the ode in those three movements. But really, it's syntax. I mean, listen to this. They sat down once, a thing on Henry's heart, so heavy. And he even puts a diacritical mark there, the way Will, if he had 100 years and more, and weeping, sleepless, in all them time, Henry could not make good. And there's that same kind of twisted around, interrupting, hiccuping, parenthetical syntax, as in Hopkins. That kid got an A for the day.
Yeah, no kidding. That's incredible. He almost deserves an A for the semester. That's so mind-blowing. I mean, I can totally imagine no worst. There is none, yeah. Mr. Bones.
Yeah.
Like there's a
no worst. There ain't none. Kind of,
yeah, exactly. It would be there ain't none, Mr.
They
Bones.
Really are. It is incredible.
That's incredible.
And, you know, for 2 days, I've just been walking around thinking about that now, trying not to make an outline for an essay because I don't have time to write that essay, but somebody should write that essay.
Yes, somebody please. I don't have time either. If you're listening, please write it. Were they able ultimately to summarize the poem and or how, I'm curious, did they end up summarizing it or paraphrasing
it? Oh, yeah, we worked through the poem pretty fully, you know, line by line, sentence by sentence, to see the movement and how the movement in the landscape and in the patterns of image suited the sonnet, or how he suited those things to the sonnet. It works really well in a sonnet in its components. I think they had a really good clear sense of what's happening, or as much as it's possible. There are some things in this poem I still don't know for sure that I have a sense of as well.
That's Hopkins. He will leave some of it just almost completely
incomprehensible.
Yeah, some
of the vocabulary is either so archaic or so clipped. He hears something in the Greek or something in the Latin, and I don't have access to it. You, like, here, creep, wretch, under a comfort serves in a whirlwind. That clause I think about all the time to try to figure it out, and I still don't know what it means. I can see the grammar, like, okay, here, right here, as we're hanging on to this cliff, creep, which is the predicate, it's an imperative word, we're going to creep along, and wretch, one of my students thought that was, he was calling somebody, here, creep, you wretch. It's kind of like that. Here, creep, wretch, under a comfort serves in a whirlwind. It serves. I don't know how to read that. You know, we're talking about this misery, this terrible pain. It's so awful. You can't imagine anything worse. It's no man fathomed, you know. And the chasm is so deep, there's no bottom to it. No man fathomed as it measured and or understood, either one. And these mountains that is the mind, hold them cheap, don't regard them, may, who never hung there. If you've never been here, you don't know how bad this is. Nor does long, our small endurance, deal with that. We can't handle it for long. Our little endurance, our small capability to cope, exhausts quickly. So we're going to fall. So here, creep, under a comfort serves in a whirlwind. So this is, it's as if to say, here, creep along here. This is the only comfort you're going to get here in this maelstrom. And the comfort is simply that you're going to die. If that's comfort, you know, all life, you know, this misery won't go on forever. All life does end, and each day dies with sleep. That's old comfort. But that's the only comfort that we can find here. You won't always feel this horrible misery. This is misery for the human being, not for the afterlife, not for the angelic. But until we get to that, we have to suffer through this terribleness.
It's fascinating thinking about it in terms of readers. The hold them cheap, may, who ne'er hung there. And one of the things the poem is doing is conveying so heavily in that first stanza how this feeling feels, basically. And there's a tension between the complexity of the syntax. But one of the things I love about the poem, and I feel like Hopkins does this quite a bit, there have been so many pauses within lines, so many caesuras, so many sentences that have these backtrackings and repetitions. And then the last word, the next to last line, then the last line, all life, death does end, and each day dies with sleep. We get no pauses. There's a sort of clarity of a song that isn't there in the rest of the poem. And it feels appropriate. Yeah. But, you know, we end on sleep. There's this kind of ease that comes at the end of the sonnet that is just, I think, really, really powerful, and something that I always love about Hopkins. One of my favorite lines of poetry in any poem is the end of God's
grandeur.
And with
all bright wings.
The all bright wings.
The thing that happens at the end of this one, it is a kind of really, really, really dark clarity of syntax. I think, let me make sure before I say this, I think we may have talked about this. In that last clause, all of those words are single syllables. All life, death does end, and each day dies with sleep. Compare that to the hyphenates, the multisyllabic words from above in the poem. There's this kind of clearing of the mind. Yeah, it's a beautiful closure.
And it's interesting. I hadn't thought about this, but the faith in the poem is this sort of feeling the absence of faith. There is no consolation of, it's not life, death does end, and then there's the reward. It's not like the Dylan Thomas, after the first death, there is no other. It's just simply, there is the death. It's really kind of amazing. One of the things I wanted to mention, and I'm sure the students drew attention to it because it's such a feature of so much all Hopkins, is really, really heavy repetition, sometimes of sound, sometimes of language. So the first line, we get pitched past pitch, pangs will schooled at four pangs, comforter, where is your comforting? There's all this repetition that brings us into the poem. And then of course we get the line, nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep here creep. We get that eep quite a bit there.
We do. Yeah, the sound is so densely packed in Hopkins, it is simply not possible to read him fast, partly because of that really, really chewy, chunky syntax and heavy consonants and alliteration. He has to be, as he says, no, he even divides the words in half. You have to linger with Hopkins. Because, I mean, in a poem like this, because partly it's miserable in there, but when you get to the end, it's over. So we're gonna remain in the misery for a little while here.
On the last episode, I was talking with Lisa Bernstein, who is a singer as well as a poet, and she was talking about how you're always singing from vowel to vowel, but Hopkins doesn't let you do that. No worst, there is none, pitched past pitch of grief, that like you're hitting the consonants hard and there's no way to move from vowel to vowel. And crunchy, I like the word crunchy, for that's actually the word I use when I talk about God's grandeur, especially the first stanza, that the way that R's interact with other consonants create this slowness and the crunchiness. And yeah, there's no moving. I mean, I think of him often in terms of the vowels, because, you know, there's that steep, deep creep, but we can't move vowel to vowel because of the way the consonants often create that stoppage along with the syntax.
Well, along with the syntax, I mean, even from that very first sentence, which is unnaturally phrased, one would say, there's nothing worse than this. But to begin with the spondee, as Marianne Moore said somewhere in a letter, try to begin your poems with a spondee. Boom, boom. No worse, there is none. He does invert, even in a little bitty sentence like that, he does invert the syntax for the sake of drama, for the sake of the narrative. In each of the first several sentences, I think he holds off on the main clause, no worse, there is none. Past pitch of grief, which would be a participle, more pangs will, parenthetical, school to four pangs, wilder ring. So there's the clause. Comforter, where is your comfort? There's the clause. He's deferring or delaying a little while, landing on that main grammatical unit, which gets reversed at the end of the poem, where he's beginning those clauses with, here, creep under a comfort, main clause. All life, death does end, main clause. He's turned the syntax around.
Yeah, there's still some hesitation, but it's much more, like even the start of the second stanza, oh, the mind has mountains. Like we're immediately encountering the subject of the sentence, and it doesn't have the kind of inversion of no worse, there is none. Right. Yeah, he's such a good sentence writer.
Oh, yeah. My students, you know, they're like, do you think he meant all that stuff? And, you know, I don't know what to say. On first draft, no. On 50th draft, yup. None of this is an accident, but it's a matter of discovery in the process of rewriting something or rehearing something or moving the pieces around. He was obsessive about revising the poems and not happy with them. He did not want these poems published.
Well, good for us that someone didn't follow
his
wishes.
There were, similarly, I would like to see that batch that were burned. Some of his poems were burned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, yeah, like Kafka.
Yeah, there's a fantastic essay by Patricia Hampel about the sort of ethics of who gets to choose what gets shared with the world. In part, she's writing about the fact that she's written about her mother, and then she gets into Kafka and the desire, you know, for Max Brod to destroy all of his journals, and then his wife, Kafka's wife, not wanting them released, but also this knowledge that they're almost certainly things that were taken and destroyed by the Nazis.
Yeah.
You know, in that there's something tantalizing about what isn't there. And I feel that with Hopkins, though I also feel the great joy of what we have. My cries heave, herds long, huddle in a mane. And I feel like he does something that I'm often telling students to avoid doing, which is with alliteration, hitting the same sound at the start of a lot of words in a row. But I think what helps it not feel sing-songy here is those pauses. My cries heave, herds long, huddle in a mane. Rather than sort of hitting them very, very quickly, we take them each piece by piece. And so we hear the alliteration, but it's not the sort of sing-songy that...
There's so many. He imposes so many impediments to a kind of velocity or an easiness of movement so that those really close alliterations or consonants have room to for us to discover them. Maybe that's a way to say it. That's a cool sentence. My cries heave, herds long. Okay, I get that. And so we're talking about a kind of pastoral scene here with this herd of sheep or, you know, the believers. And then a semicolon, huddle in a mane. And then you realize that huddle is the second predicate for the clause. My cries heave, my cries huddle, and my cries wince and sing. Then my cries lull, then leave off. There's only one subject to the sentence and all of those predicates. And he's really canny about the use of those semicolons to let us see those grammatical units, those the rest of those predicates in a row. Otherwise, we could never even know what was happening here.
And it also creates this incredible scale. I love the images, the herds long, an age-old anvil wince and sing, the violence of that and how it rings out, and then lull, then leave off. And he's capturing the various kinds of feelings. Like lull is very different than the heaving, very different than the wincing and singing. That there are, I don't like that the idea of the stages of grief, because I know they're real, but that somehow a lot of people think that they go in order when they don't. But we see different stages, different experiences of this deep melancholy.
And they're all in that order, in that row, mimetic of the loud strike of metal and then the echo and the fading away of that sound. They wince, hurts, then they sing, then they lull, then they leave off. And you hear this kind of fading percussion or sound of the sorrow. It's so beautifully done.
It really is. Yeah, it's incredible. I have a question about the modern poetry class. Yeah. I'm curious why you start with Hopkins.
I don't know where to start the class. Helen Vindler makes a pretty good case for, and so does Bloom, Shakespeare being a modernist, you know, Keats being a modernist, Whitman being a modernist. So I spent a week or two in this class on 19th century anticipations of things like modern, with difficulty with the advent of free verse with Whitman, with a kind of interiority with Keats. But I really kind of land first on Yeats and Frost, who are pretty good examples to bring the 19th century into the 20th century in their early work, which was written. I mean, these guys were alive for 30 some years in the 19th century, 35 years, and sound like Romantic and Victorian poets, and then become something else, especially Yeats. So that's kind of how I do it.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is sort of hard to do. Like, it's always difficult thinking about historical trajectories because it's a simpler way to think about things, but there are often writers who don't fit our sort of historical categories.
Yeah.
Or I'm thinking of the painter, there was a huge exhibition at the Guggenheim, Hilma A.F. Klimt, several years ago, and her paintings, they are like nothing that preceded her, and she's preceding abstraction and all kinds of movements, and no one knows of her as this, it's like Dickinson, this incredible outlier doing something that's going to anticipate so much movement. It just totally muddies every idea of, oh, these things develop in these stages.
Wow.
Because it's not as if a writer is you know, one sort of self-enclosed hole. Like you said, Yeats is a pretty large movement from writing in a Victorian mode to doing much more kind of modern work.
Yeah. So. And he got to that modern work sort of kicking and screaming. He didn't really want to be the public political voice of the troubles and the wars, but he became that. One of his aspects of greatness.
Was there anything else you want to say about this poem before we transition to the silliness?
There are many things to say. It's one of the best poems that I know to just talk about the... Here's the thing with Hopkins. He's so intellectual. He's so smart, but he's even more soulful. He is such a feeling poet. And, you know, in a poem like this, the feeling is tortured. And I think that's one of the things to take away. We've kind of made a brand of trauma in the last 5 or 10 years in contemporary poetry. Everybody has a wound and a scar and a trauma and a pain and a whatever until it just becomes a cliche. Nobody can express a kind of genuine spiritual, existential, bodily trauma as clearly or as deeply as Hopkins. That's a thing to say. And this is the poem that I go to as an example of him at his most powerful.
And well, part of what makes him such a pleasure to read is the way in which he's so attuned to sound really brings us so fully into the feeling of this poem and God's grandeur. Maybe my favorite poet to reread aloud.
Yeah.
For that. So, all right, before we get to the game, and you've heard this ad before, but I made a small change. We do have an ad. Poets need to hydrate. Take, for example, Gerard Manley Hopkins. In his younger days, he argued that people drank more liquids than they needed. And as stubborn as all priests are, he bet that he could go without drinking for a week. And that lasted until his tongue turned black and he collapsed at drill. True story. But the estate of Gerard Manley Hopkins has done an about-face and is introducing a variety of beers.
Yeah.
Gerard Manley's Hop Cans. Sometimes
is this
poets
true?
Enjoy...
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Of course. Yes, sometimes poets enjoy catching fire with drink or tumbling over rims and round AOLs. You'll feel sprung in your feet. The Hop Cans brews include the Porter, the Ooze of Oil, the Chocolate Stout Man's Smudge, the Blonde Ale Golden Grove Unleaving, the IPA Sheer Plod, and of course the popular Sour Ale Wanwood Leaf Meal. So after you've spilled your ink, sit back and quench your thirst with a pint from the estate of Gerard Manley Hopkins. It'll give you a warm breast and bright wings.
Fantastic. So,
thank you. I delight in writing those. So
sure.
On to the game. Today we are returning to a game that I played with Amit Majmudar, and this time I'm calling it Misinformation. And that is deliberately pronounced that way. I'm going to give you the name of a poetic form, except the trick is some of these are real poetic forms and some of them are not.
Okay.
They're fake. So your job is to tell me which ones are real and which ones are fake. And if, as a bonus, if you want to invent a form for the fake terms, we can do that. Amit was incredible.
Oh, well, yeah,
at
that's
it.
His
it was just,
wheelhouse.
Yeah. Totally off the dome. There'll be five of these. Do you have any questions before we play?
I will have to hear the first one to understand the apparatus, but I think I get it.
Okay. Number one, is there such a poetic form as a tri-cube?
No.
I'm afraid you're wrong. It's a poem of 9 lines, so 3-line stanzas of 3 lines each, and each line has 3 syllables. So it's cubed in that way.
I don't know that one.
It seems very difficult to pull off. Number
I think
two.
The thing that,
oh, go ahead.
Cubed, tri is 3 and a cube has 4 sides. So I was thinking there's something bogus in that. But yeah, I see.
Number two, a polycule.
No, I don't think so.
You're absolutely right. A polycule is 3 or more people who are connected romantically and or sexually.
But that should be a form.
Yeah. It has a physical form, but is not technically a poetic form. I'd love to see like a 3-person crown of sonnets somehow. I don't know how you would make that work. Number three, is there such a thing as a boho sonnet?
Yes.
I'm afraid there's not. I found going through a list of forms, all these different, blank sonnets. You want to try to invent the form for the boho sonnet.
that, you know, you could, it's bohemian, so it'd have to have some sort of snapping and coffee house and a beat feeling to it, you know, as if, let's say, Ginsberg wrote a sonnet. Actually, Ginsberg did write sonnets, but that's what I was thinking when I heard the term.
Yeah, maybe we can go back and rename those boho sonnets. Yeah. It feels like a useful word.
Had lunch poems. How about boho sonnets? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Number four, and I'm presuming I'm mispronouncing this, a Brekbærn. It's a Brekbærn.
Spelled it.
It's spelled Brekbærne.
N-E. Yeah, I think there is.
There is. It's an Irish form, hence my inability to pronounce it. And these are the rules. It's in quatrains, 5 syllables in the first line, 6 syllables in the 3 other lines. Each line ends with a 2-syllable word, and then lines 2 and 4 rhyme. So there's some intricacy to it, and I especially like the idea of ending each line with a 2-syllable word. It creates...
I do, too.
In the couple of examples I read, the rhythm it creates is really, really... has a nice ring to it, for lack of a better phrase. So...
that's a good one.
All right. Number 5 is an audio clue. This is the last one, and I can't pronounce it. There are lots of really interesting Welsh forms. I'm going to play you the audio of first one person and then multiple people saying the name of this either form or not form. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I did.
Would you like to hear it several more times?
I kind of need to.
Llanfair pwll gwyngys go gerych chwyrn drobl Llantysilio go go goch.
Llanfair pwll gwyngys go gerych chwyrn drobl Llantysilio go go goch.
Llanfair pwll gwyngys go gerych chwyrn drobl Llantysilio go go goch.
Llanfair pwll gwyngys go gerych chwyrn drobl Llantysilio go go goch.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Is that a poetic form?
Yes.
I'm afraid it's not, but it should be.
They sold it.
It's the name of a Welsh town, and it's it's 58 letters. It's the longest town name in Europe, which a cobbler came up with it because he thought it would boost tourism. It would be good for the town. And so they have a shorthand that they write on envelopes. You can't, you know, it's not really ideal to write the entire town name, but it means, so it was created in the 1860s by a cobbler. It means St. Mary's Church in the hollow of the White Hazel near a rapid whirlpool and the Church of St. Cilio near the Red Cave.
Fantastic. I love that. There's a poet, a guy named Lewis Turco. I don't know if you know that name.
I do, yeah. The Book of Forms.
The Book of Forms. When he was, this is 30, 40, 50 years ago, writing kind of in his 40s and 50s, he had a pen name. He made up a name, Wesley Court, WESLICOURT, which is just an anagram of his own name. But nobody knew this. And he began to publish poems, and he was publishing poems in archaic Welsh forms. That's why I'm saying this. He knows all the Welsh poetry forms. There's zillions of them. And if you Google Wesley Court, you might find some of those.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, there's a guy, Robert Lee Brewer, keeps a list of different forms for Writer's Digest. And there is a handful of Welsh forms. And it's really fun to write in them because they create a kind of songiness that I really like. I've never successfully written one, but I do enjoy writing in the form. So, David, thank you again so much for being here. Is there anything you'd like to say or plug before we go?
No, I'm just grateful for the chance to talk about poems and Hopkins and my students. I am retiring this semester, so I will not be teaching this class or students in any prolonged way. And so I'm in my last few weeks of it. So it's kind of nice to have this occasion to talk about poetry. But I appreciate your asking me here, and I appreciate your podcast. It's a great
deal
of fun. And the games are a hoot.
I enjoy the games. I'm still figuring out the level of difficulty. And congratulations, though, on your final semester.
Yeah, I have some other things I want to do now. So I'm going to do some of those things with a little more enthusiasm. But okay, a plug. I have a book that was published about a year ago called Whale Fall, Book of Poems, Norton. And the paperback edition was released a week and a half ago. So I have a new paperback of Whale Fall. So there's my plug.
I will second that plug. People should read Whale Fall. It's fantastic.
Thanks to
everybody for listening. Have a great day. Go read some poems, pet some dogs, and support striking workers wherever you find them. Bye.